Hi, everyone, and welcome to Futures in Languages, a podcast showcasing stories from UCF's Modern Languages and Literatures Department alumni. I'm your host, Christina Torres, and today we'll be talking with Lindsay Morrison, who graduated from the MA TESOL program in spring of 2023. Lindsay is a returned Peace Corps volunteer, having served in Comoros, in specifically the Mohéli Island, and she is now in Boston working as a program ESOL and family engagement administrator for the Casserly House. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lindsay.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Torres, and the Knights willing to listen.
It is so great to catch up with you here. And we were just chatting before the recording started about how time, it just feels like it's passed so quickly since your graduation. We have a lot to catch up on and a short amount of time. For those who didn't have the pleasure of working with you during your time at UCF, could you share with our listeners a little bit about yourself and where you're from?
Absolutely. I love answering the question, where are you from? Because I probably have the world's longest answer for it. Simplest version is I'm from the United States because I lived in about four different states by the time I was 14 years old. And I was born in Ohio originally, but eventually my family moved to Florida when I was entering high school. I ended up going to FSU in Tallahassee for my undergraduate degree, went off to the Peace Corps after graduating with a degree in English education. And yeah, after Peace Corps, I eventually came back to Florida to get my master's degree in Orlando.
Yeah. And what inspired you to go into English education as your undergraduate?
I have always loved words and stories and the magic of language to communicate ideas and feelings and imagination. As a kid, I always joked that I was going to be an author or an actress or an artist. And eventually I realized that I really had a passion for sharing the language and the stories and the words that teachers had shared with me. So I thought as a good backup, if being an author, actress, artist didn't work out, maybe it would be good to have a degree in English education and kind of pass that on to future generations, that love I have for English. But then I got a totally new perspective on English when I started teaching it overseas in the Peace Corps, because it brought a new perspective to my own language that I never had before. And I thought that was really interesting, and it kind of took me by surprise how much that changed my life.
Yeah, I can imagine. Everyone that I have spoken to that has been in the Peace Corps have talked about their experiences as foundational to who they are today and present time. I would imagine, and I'm curious how you feel about this, but sometimes I think teaching has a little bit of a theatrical lens to it, and that you're almost preparing a show. Not that teaching is, not that every lecture is like a show, but you are doing a lot of prep work. It's getting your lines right, and you're thinking about your presentation, and you are making sure you're engaging your audience, and there's a little bit of theatricality. So maybe that's one of those lenses that you can, you know, like you achieved your theater in the classroom, so to speak.
No, I completely agree, especially ESOL, because when you're working with people who are very new to English, and they have, at least the way I've always taught and found that works, is to be incredibly physical and animated in your face and kind of overly theatrical to communicate happiness or sadness or confusion, and really make it more obvious that even if you don't understand the words I'm saying, everything else can help you make that connection and have that click of, oh, this must be what she means. I can't translate it literally, but this is the vibe I'm getting. I love that ESOL lets me do that.
It's nice to be able to provide that additional context in those classes of the beginner folks. It's fun to teach beginner level. It's fun to teach all the levels, but beginner has a special place, you know. Mm-hmm. Very rewarding. When we talk about our alumni on the podcast, we often talk about what they've done since graduation, but I feel like it's so foundational for us to at least touch on Peace Corps a little bit in your episode. Could you share with our listeners maybe about the decision-making process to go into Peace Corps and how that trajectory began for you?
Absolutely. So as I was getting my degree in English education, I was going to graduate a year early from college. I came in with a lot of AP credits and so on. So I was thinking about, I was really fortunate and able to finish my undergraduate degree without any debt, without taking out any loans. And I kind of wanted to do some sort of service work or volunteering to kind of pay it forward and pay back that generosity I felt like I had and getting really good scholarships and so on. So I was researching different places and programs where I could serve somewhere. And Peace Corps just kind of came up again and again in my searching, not because I knew anyone who'd done it before, not because anyone really told me about it necessarily. It was a very vague thing I'd heard of only in movies and TV shows. But as I researched it more, I saw that it was a 2-year long service, and I felt like that was enough time to get acquainted and kind of integrated into a new place to the point that maybe something I was doing was making an impact or was, yeah, having a significant influence on someone in the community, perhaps, mm-hmm. without suddenly declaring that I'm going to spend 5 or 10 years of my life in a country I've never been to before, because I wanted something new, but I didn't want to make a commitment that was years and years, because it's in my head, 2 years didn't sound that long. You know, it's like, oh, about half of high school, about half of college. But I definitely underestimated how different 2 years feels when it's in a culture that is completely different than your own, for sure.
Yeah. And Peace Corps provides training. How yes. would you say the training at the beginning of Peace Corps, because you were trained as an English teacher also, mm-hmm. how did that combine as part of your initial prep into Peace Corps?
Yeah, so I had a background as I'd done just recently an internship at a high school in Tallahassee. And then a couple months later, I was on a plane heading to Comoros. And the first 3 months of Peace Corps is always intensive 9 to 5, 5 day a week training. Mm-hmm. Predominantly, you're learning the local language of the site you're going to be volunteering in. So I was going to be on the island of Moheli. So I was learning the local dialect there. But they also have a lot of other sessions on cultural shock, on how to teach ESOL, because not everyone has an English education background, and not everyone had a background in ESOL. So we had quite a few classes on that too. Other things more realistically about how to stay healthy and use your water filter and take your malaria medicine safely and all of that kind of thing, because it is a very different developmental structure to live in. Yeah, and that training was super, super helpful and helped me kind of prepare for some of the bigger things at site. Unfortunately, even though I had classes in the local language every single day, practically for several months, I still didn't get that fluent in the local dialect until I'd lived at site for a much longer time. So I think that shows a lot too about just how hard it is to learn another language. And how even if you think you're going to be a master of it because you love, I don't know, like I was a word nerd, always have been, it would come easier to me, but in some ways it was a lot harder. Yeah, so it was interesting to see how much it did prepare me, but couldn't really fully prepare me for the adjustment.
Yeah, I'd imagine that no matter how much you prepare, the reality of the location really becomes clearest as soon as you're like on the ground, as soon as you've moved in and suddenly you're there in your location and you're like, okay, we're working on Monday. Let's go. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another great part of training is usually you do have one site visit. So you do get to see where you're going to be living. You get to see your village or city before training is officially done. You go there for like a long weekend or whatever. So that was really helpful too. I'm glad we had that. So it wasn't quite as much as a, oh, here's the reality today, that it was finally time to move.
Yeah. I've heard a couple different places that Peace Corps is often considered the hardest job you'll ever love. And so I'm sure that you have lots of stories from that time. But is there one, maybe are there one or two stories that stand out to you that you'd like our listeners to know about that experience?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's so hard to boil it down to even just one or two stories, but I think one of my favorite stories was during training, for whatever reason, I had put that I could sing on my resume. And during training, our country director, so kind of the leader of Peace Corps in Comoros, asked if I wanted to sing the national anthem at our swearing-in ceremony. After your 3 months of training is up, there's a swearing-in ceremony. And I said, okay, I guess I'll try to sing the national anthem. I'm doing something I never would have thought in a place I never would have thought before. Why not? Why not push myself? Despite the fact I'd never sung a solo in my life before. I'd only ever sung as a choir. It's like, I'll try to
kid too. Yay. Okay. I'm an altar, but yeah.
Then he also realized a few days later, you know what? If you're going to sing the national anthem in English, we actually need to sing national anthem Comoros as well. We don't really have a singer for the Comorian anthem. You want to try to learn it? and I listened to it. Someone played it for me, someone who would become one of my dearest friends, who might be my second story if we have time for it. Mm-hmm. But she kind of taught me the words. It was actually a pretty catchy song, and I'd learned how to sing songs in foreign languages before. Mm-hmm. So I decided, yeah, I think I want to learn how to sing it. But it wasn't just the like moment of having that song on the swearing-in ceremony that was great. It was great. It was the learning process of memorizing this song. I would sing with people in my host family. While you're in training, you're usually with a host family. So I had a host family that I would sing to every night, and they would help me memorize the words. Whenever strangers came over to the house, they'd be like, oh, show them what you memorized. Show them what, sing for us. And I would travel to other people's houses. And then even eventually at site, when I started working at a local middle school in Mohali, when it was appropriate every once in a while, I was like, you know what? I can sing this song. And I would sing the national anthem, and it would just blow everyone's mind that I knew how to sing it at all. But it was such a beautiful moment of connection, because I was really sharing in something that was culturally so important to people, and just something that most of them had never seen before. Comoros is a country that was a colony of France for a very long time and still has a lot of the scars of that colonization. Mm. And sometimes just something as simple as seeing someone who's very visibly a foreigner, as I was a white woman volunteering in a country that's predominantly Black, just seeing something like, oh, someone trying, like she's trying to actually appreciate and celebrate the culture without coming in to change things, I think was something that something as small as singing the national anthem really did connect with a lot of people in a way they might not have expected, and I didn't expect either.
That is such a beautiful story. And you know what? I am curious to hear about the person that became one of your really close friends, the ones that helped you learn the song, if you don't mind me asking.
Yes, I would love to talk about her. I will talk 500 hours about her because she is someone I adore so much. I call her my big sister, my mentor. In Shikomori, we say Mantiti, which means big sister. So I call her that all the time. And her name is Haina. And Haina is a member of Peace Corps staff. So she's also just probably the smartest person I've ever met. She's from Comoros, and as a person who is a descendant of kind of all three islands, Comoros has predominantly three main islands and then a fourth one that's still a part of France. And Haina speaks the dialect of all those three islands because her father's from one island, her mother's from another, and she was born and raised on the biggest island. Eventually went to college in Madagascar, so she learned some Malagasy language. She speaks French fluently. She speaks English fluently as well, and knows all these crazy word nerd things that I would have never expected. Yeah, so Haina was someone I met while I was in training, but we became really, really good friends over shared loves of books and obscure TV shows I hadn't thought anyone else had ever watched, but somehow she had found a downloaded copy of when she was in college and happened to watch it too. Our shared love of ice cream, of all things. I've gotten to see her twice since leaving Peace Corps. Once I got to visit her in Spain, and once she got to visit me in Orlando, which was amazing. Right before I moved to Boston, she was in town for a Peace Corps conference. And Haina is so much of a powerhouse mentally, and the things that she's overcome in her life and continues to plow through just amaze me constantly. She's had a lot of health issues, and she's really, really passionate about the NGO that she runs. In addition to working as a Peace Corps Comoros staff person, she also runs an NGO that teaches kids in villages near where she lives about robotics, about sexual health, like maintaining how to make and remake menstrual pads, because that's a big obstacle for girls to go to school, is to not have access. You can't really purchase pads or tampons in Comoros. They're not imported. They're not easy to access. Mm. And Haina just does so many amazing things with her kids, with her girls, to teach them more about things that in a very conservative culture, they don't talk about openly as much. And yeah, she continues to blow me away and is going through something really hard right now too. So it's hard not to get emotional talking about her. But yeah, I'm continued to just be in awe and so grateful for her friendship. Specifically when I was in Peace Corps, one of the greatest things that we got to participate in was part of Let Girls Learn, which is something that originally was started by Michelle Obama. Mm-hmm. And partnered with Peace Corps to do conferences and different events to teach educators and to teach other people more about the obstacles to girls' education in sub-Saharan Africa and other places around the world too. And to see Haina lead and facilitate conversations and activities across 4 days in essentially three different languages, I'll like never forget just sitting back and watching her move and instruct and make all of these questions happening while translation is happening. And I was just like, this is the coolest person I know. I want to be her someday when I grow up. Yeah, I adore her to pieces.
She sounds like such an inspirational person for really all of us, and how fortunate that you were able to meet her and to get to know her on that deep personal level.
The work that she does and the way that she just continues to help and serve and put her all into supporting her community and developing the educational needs of so many people. It's like, you gotta get behind her. Even if she'll never enjoy having the spotlight on her, you gotta show the spotlight there.
Yeah, we have listeners from all over the world on this podcast. So if folks are listening and they would like to support that NGO, contact us. We'll figure out a way to get you in
touch.
Yeah, we will figure out a way. Thank you for sharing those stories, Lindsay. And I think that's a nice transition into what you're doing now, because now you're working in an administrative position. Can you share with our listeners a little bit more about your current job position with Casserly House?
Absolutely. So Casserly House is a place of welcome and connection for immigrants and refugees in Boston. We center on one neighborhood in Boston specifically, more towards the southwest, called Roslindale. And we also like to be a neighborhood partner and collaborate on different issues that come up in our community, such as housing, gentrification, and those kinds of things. But the primary way we support our community is through offering free classes in the mornings, ESOL, to people who can come. We literally operate out of a house. That is why it's called Casserly House. We are on the first floor of one of the three-decker buildings, and we operate classes out of a former kitchen, out of a former dining room, out of a former living room. And because we have a much smaller scale, we only have about 15 people that come in per day, but in total, by the end of the week, 30 different people get to learn English twice a week with us, which is really, really cool. So in my role, I often organize events regarding family engagement to connect with families and neighbors, make sure we have things going on for the kids in the community every so often. But most of my day-to-day is taken up by being the resident expert in ESOL, because we have an amazing, amazing group of volunteers who instruct our classes, but most of them are from professional backgrounds that aren't necessarily education. Mm-hmm. So they need a lot of support when it comes to lesson planning and making sure that progress is being made and communication is happening when a volunteer isn't there, because people are giving out of their free time to be here, you know, 2.5 hours every single week. Part of my job is supporting and connecting learners to their classes, making sure the classes progress well, even if not every day has the exact same instructor. So I really love getting to support in that way. Every once in a while, if a volunteer instructor is sick and can't come in or something like that, I will substitute for classes as well. So I still feel like I get to teach, even though my role is still more officially administrative.
It's nice that you're able to get a sense of both worlds, with the classroom world and the administrative world. So you've got the macro and the micro, and you're getting to know these folks. I'd imagine that a program that's at this level of size feels cozy to a certain extent.
Yes, it absolutely is cozy. That's a good word for it.
Yeah. And generally, I'm curious, how do the levels work when it comes to learners? Is it mixed level classes? Like, what are some of the goals in the classes at this organization?
Yeah, great question. So we try to specialize in people who are very newly arrived to the United States. The vast majority of our adult learners have been here for less than 2 years, I would say. So we really try to have most of our classes be, we group people by level. So that was one of the things I did when I first started, was assessing everyone to see if they were in correct groupings. But we kind of call our levels beginners, intermediate. And I also have a group that's more like free beginner, because some of them don't have literacy in their first language. So it's not just that they're learning English. They might also be learning how to read and write, if not for the very first time, read and write in a way that they really haven't ever fully finished, because maybe they never finished middle school or high school. So they're still developing those skills as well. And they just realistically need even more time and one-on-one attention to support their language acquisition.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine that's a very rewarding experience too, for all involved, to be the ones there to make that connection into those steps for literacy when we've had interrupted education.
Yeah. I think all of the volunteers would agree with that. And just in general, like, when you get to work with this particular population, you just meet some of the most amazing people, and you really feel that you are being useful and helpful, but they're so kind and generous and helpful to you too. A lot of our volunteers are older, they're often retirees. So one thing we're trying to do more of is use technology in the classroom, and it's really great to see adult learners helping their instructors when that technology doesn't go according to plan. And it's kind of that beautiful balance of giving and taking and receiving is on both sides. Absolutely. Everyone is learning at the same time. They're learning different things, but it's a lifelong learning process for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Teaching in general is signing up for being a lifelong learner, which is something that I've always found really cool and valuable in this field.
Yeah.
But I have learned so much from all the folks that have come through my classes and my colleagues as well. And I can just envision all the different backgrounds that you are working with and all the different stories. And going back to your love of storytelling, I'm sure that you had a chance to interact and storytell as part of this job that you're doing now. What a beautiful way to serve that community.
Thank you.
You talked about you're in an administrator position, which I'm assuming is different from your role in the Peace Corps. Going back to the MA program, because you were here for the Master's in TESOL program for those 2 years, how did you find the ART program? That's part one. And part two is, how did some of the things that you learned in that program translate into your day-to-day now?
Absolutely. So I found out about the program at UCF because I was researching different Peace Corps Coverdell Fellows, which is a way that sometimes if you complete your service of 2 years in Peace Corps, you can qualify for scholarships at school. And there's a website that has all of these Coverdell Fellow options. And I was trying to find any support for that was more focused on ESOL. And it just so happens that UCF is one of the only places where that is that connection with Peace Corps Coverdell, which was really amazing. So I was able to apply to be a TA and a Coverdell Fellow at UCF while I was getting my master's. So I was able to be a teaching assistant and teaching associate my 2 years while I was here, which was great. I got paid to go to grad school. So that's a pretty awesome thing that I'm very grateful for. Sorry, remind me your second question again.
Yeah, so the second part is, how did some of the things that you learned during your time in those 2 years of graduate school translate into your life now?
Yeah, grad school taught me a lot of things that relate to what I do now, whether it was something like Dr. Perminsky's assessment class. I learned a lot from that, and to use for more informal assessments with adult learners in a very different educational environment. Because in the past, before doing my master's, I was mainly teaching in a more K-12 environment. So I also learned a lot about teaching adults from the master's program. I'm teaching very different kinds of communities. While I was in Orlando, I was able to be an adjunct instructor at Seminole State as well and work with that adult community. And that's how I realized that I really, really fell in love with and enjoy working with adult learners in that population group. And I wouldn't have never found that job or ended up doing that if it hadn't been for the master's program in Orlando. So I'm super grateful for that. Yeah, there are so many different concepts that we covered in classes or things that our books discuss that I honestly do still use. There have been multiple times where I'm like, let me grab this textbook so I can explain to another instructor why this grammar point matters, or so I can find the best way to assess something that hasn't been assessed in the program before, because my position is a new one. There hasn't been an administrator at Casterly House in the past, and there's a lot of change that has been happening, hopefully for improvement and hopefully for good. And part of that is because of the knowledge I gained at UCF, for sure.
Yeah, and you talked about assessment, and that class is so helpful, very foundational to what we do in teaching, right?
Yes.
We teach, we assess, we find out if we're teaching, we find out if it's landing the way that we want things to land. But it sounds like you have the opportunity to really drive what this job is for this program and how that will grow as you are in that position. And what a cool opportunity to, again, help this organization, but also to shape the position that helps the organization.
Absolutely. I hope so. Yeah, it's really amazing to have this kind of flexibility because it's not as structured as a traditional school. We don't have to have people pass a certain exam in order to start or to finish. It's really, really more under what are the needs that people actually have and how can we meet those needs realistically, because we are a small size, but also much more personally and relationally because we're a small size. Like, there's no way I would ever not know every single person by name in the program. I will always know that because of our size. And I think that's, yeah, part of why it's really great to have that flexibility to find ways to make the program work for what it is, and hopefully for this role in the future too, so that if it changes for someone else, there's a strong foundation that they get to operate from.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you have a lot of stories, but I'm curious for our listeners if you could maybe share what quote-unquote typical day or week for you might look like in this position. Anything that stands out to share with our listeners?
Yeah. Okay. So typical week, it is like pretty traditional, usually 9 to 5, 40 hours a week total. Every once in a while, we'll have an event in the evening. So maybe I'll leave work early on Friday because we did something special that week. But normally I show up at work at 9 a.m. and leave around 5 p.m. I live super close to where I work. So I literally walk just a little 8-minute walk. It's the perfect commute.
Sounds amazing.
And, yes. And our classes begin at 10 o'clock in the morning. They end at 12. So when I arrive at 9 o'clock, I'm essentially prepping textbooks and making sure the lessons have all been printed out and ready. If there are worksheets, they're stacked for the volunteer instructors to just kind of grab and go. And once classes kind of begin, instructors have arrived, they know which room they're in, they know who they're going to be working with. Usually it's the same people every week. Sometimes you have a substitute, you never know what's going to happen. You have to be on your feet always, because it's always a surprise. But usually by 10 o'clock, all I have to do in the classroom is to take attendance occasionally. If there's a question around how to use a laptop, I might step in for something like that. But otherwise, I go back to my computer and work on other more administrative questions, emails, Excel spreadsheets, and Word documents as we're trying to continue to grow the resources that we have so we can offer even more personalized and kind of supportive resources to anyone who walks in through our door. That is very much something that is very typical, especially in the afternoons. Anyone could knock and have a question about, oh, I need help with some legal things. I need to talk to immigration and I can't get a meeting and my language is low, so I don't really understand what they're saying. Also just like getting supporting people, letting them know that we are their neighbor and that that door is always something that they can knock on and come in with pretty much any question. Even if we ourselves can't fill every need, we can point them to the right direction.
Yeah, that sounds like a very satisfying thing to be able to do, either offer the help or point them in the right direction at a very important moment in their time, having arrived to the US so recently. Thank you for sharing these stories. Are you ready, Lindsay, for Ask Our Alumni? Today, we have a question from Miley. Are we ready for Miley's question?
I am ready for Miley's question. Sure. I don't know if she's ready for my answer, but here we go.
Here we go.
When you're translating a text, do you often consult a dictionary, even with confidence in your language proficiency?
Great question, Miley. So when I'm translating a text, if it is a language that I feel pretty confident in, which is mainly English, but I speak French fairly well, and I will usually refer to maybe not a physical dictionary immediately, but I'll usually refer to several different online sources that are really good about finding actual uses of the word, and they give me example sentences. So when I see those example sentences and how the word is actually used in context, I realize the meaning a little bit even easier, in my opinion, than the traditional dictionary. But oftentimes there are languages or translation things that come up and I don't have access to a physical dictionary. A lot of the adult learners who come to my NGO are speakers of Haitian Creole, and we literally just don't even have an English to Haitian Creole dictionary in our space yet because it's a more recent development. So a dictionary is helpful at times, but I usually find other resources first in terms of being more efficient. Or if ever possible, I go directly to a native speaker who is 100% confident in the language and get their opinion, because it's going to add more richness than just a dictionary ever really could.
Yeah, I hear you just mentioning the power of collaboration, how we can do translations, and it's not a bad idea to get a second opinion on translations.
Absolutely.
I'd imagine that some of the things you're translating to feel more high stakes because they're for other folks and they're for the NGO.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know I feel pressure when I'm translating something for something else, like not myself. This isn't for me. This is going, it's in service of someone else. So, and that's a theme that we've heard from other folks too, when they're translating like legal matters. So great. Thank you for answering Miley's question, Lindsay. We're about to go into our last question of today, which is, what advice would you offer someone who is interested, curious about studying TESOL? That's teaching English to speakers of other languages, for our listeners who are not familiar with the acronym.
Yeah. So if you're curious about TESOL, if you're interested in it, I would recommend trying to do one or both of two things. One, I would recommend trying to immerse yourself in a culture that is very different from your own first, to kind of go through that experience of what it is maybe to live abroad, or what it is to just be surrounded by something that's unfamiliar. Because if you find yourself in that kind of situation and absolutely hate every second of it, it never gets better and it continues to give you anxiety and stress, TESOL might not be the right path for you. And the second recommendation I would say, the second option, is if you can't, say, go live abroad, or you can't find a truly, truly, totally different place to immerse yourself in, I would say try to learn for 1, 2, even 3 years, as much as you can, try to learn another language, just to understand the process that you as a learner are going through as you're trying to learn another language, even if you don't succeed at becoming fluent in it. Simply having that empathy and that experience of how hard it is to learn another language can be really, really impactful eventually when you yourself are in the classroom, because you can think about what was stressful for you during that process, what was helpful for you, so you can be a teacher who can imagine what the students are experiencing. Even if it's never going to be exactly the same, you can use that personal experience and empathy to relate to students and design lessons catered to those realities, while also softening the harsh edges of the transition that comes in when you're trying to immerse yourself in a new language.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole identity thing, right? Like learning another language, going into that kind of setting. And I speak Spanish, I speak English, I am very, very, very beginner in French right now. Like, I can't oversell how beginner I am in French right now.
Bon courage.
Very, very little. But the process is always, it impacts us in some way, right? Yeah. Like, we're used to sounding a certain way, and suddenly it changes. And it's good, you know, I resonate with what you're saying about empathy. And I think that for folks who maybe haven't gone through the process of learning a language yet and are interested in teaching language, it is such a wonderful, really great idea to go through that experience as well. Even if you're doing it while you're training to teach, just going through that experience, because you learn some of the myths that maybe have been passed down about language learning, which I don't have time to get into today, but I'd love to on another podcast episode. But
I want to listen to that podcast. I love those myths and debunking them. It's so fascinating.
Oh my gosh, yes. Folks who are interested in myths about vocabulary learning can check out Dr. Fulce's Vocabulary Myths book, which is out there. I have no affiliation with that publisher, but it's so a good. Great book.
I had his class on that, and I loved that class, and I love his book. It is great. I recommend.
So good. So I resonate with what you're saying, Lindsay, and it's just great to get a chance to catch up with you and to hear how things are going over in Boston. Like, you're doing all this amazing work. Is there anything that you'd like to leave your episode on? Is there a final thought for your episode today?
Be kind and don't assume things about people as much as possible, but be aware of your own assumptions and when you're making them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what we don't know. So
that's true.
That's a good one to throw in there too. But you heard it from Lindsay. Be kind. Don't make assumptions. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we hope we can catch up with you in a future season.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you again, Dr. Torres. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
So great. Thank you for listening to this episode of Futures in Languages. I'd like to give a shout out to DaVideo Guy for our intro and outro music downloaded from freesound.org. I'm Christina Torres, and our featured guest today was Lindsay Morrison. Tune in next time to hear more alumni stories from modern languages. For more information about the MA in TESOL and other language programs in the Modern Languages Department, please visit our website at cah.ucf.edu/languages.